This is a production of Defocus Media. We want to thank the Chang Reaction Nation for tuning in and listening to Dr. Clark Chang showcasing eye care innovations with a special flair on cornea and contact lenses. Please show love to our team and like, share, subscribe, comment on every episode. Don't forget to follow Dr. Clark Chang and his guests on social media. And now let's step inside of the Chang Reaction.
Welcome back, Chang Reaction Nation. Thank you for tuning in to this new episode. Today, we'll be talking about all things corneal cross-linking, as you can tell from our title, Corneal Cross-Linking in USA, Fact or Myth. My special guest is Dr. Grace Lytle, who is Vice President of Medical Affairs in Avedro. And not only does she have her fingers on the pulse of cross-linking community inside of the United States, she also travels across the globe to work with international clinical researchers on new and exciting cross-linking investigations. She's part of the R&D force that is very much responsible for clinical advancements of cross-linking, and she never really has the time to sit down for an interview. So today, she's blowing her cover for just us and for you listeners. She's like the Elastigirl to cross-linking community, and yes, I just revealed my inner geek by invoking an animated superhero reference. So, Dr. Lytle, what did I miss on your impressive clinical background, and how does it feel to be compared to your superhero alter ego?
Well, thank you for that great introduction, Clark. Like you said, I've been with Avedro in various professional education and medical roles for just over 6 years. So I really enjoy my function at Avedro. It's a great chance to take the skills I learned in optometry school and in clinical practice and apply them to thinking about how to serve whole categories of patients rather than just making individual clinical decisions for specific patients. So like Elastic Girl, I spend a lot of time reviewing data, reading the peer-reviewed literature, and talking to eye care providers. We proactively seek information about experience with our technology, and we try to use that knowledge to inform our research teams who are developing our pipeline products. I'd say at the core, it's really about education. So in both directions, my team and I spend as much time learning from the experience of clinicians around the world as we do training and teaching. So it's really a back and forth. We have this great opportunity to learn from the best and brightest minds in optometry and ophthalmology, and we work to bring that information back to the company in a way that hopefully presents opportunities to better serve patients who benefit from our procedure and the doctors who use our technology as well.
That sounds excellent. I was actually going to ask you, if you knew who I was referring to, and obviously you did. Yeah, if you look up the animation, you'll realize Elastigirl is the smartest superhero of them all. So, Dr. Lytle, now, am I correct that you completed your, basically all your trainings were done in Boston or Massachusetts? Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. So I did my optometry degree at the New England College of Optometry, and then I went on to do a cornea and contact lens residency through the New England Eye Institute.
And now, so before we start, could you give us a little, just, you know, for the interest of our viewers, only because this cross-linking has been such a major force in our management tools in the last 5 to 10 years, pending, you know, when, if you were involved in a study site or not. What did it feel like when you first got involved, and what was that decision process like for you to get into something that I would assume never really popped up during your training? Because it certainly didn't for my, until I get to my fellowship site and realize there's such a thing as corneal cross-linking, you know, 8-9 years ago. How did that feel like to you? And was it really difficult to make that decision to come into, to go into Avedro?
You know, it was a difficult decision to leave practice. Of course, all of my training had been building up to practicing clinical optometry. But in my practice, I was seeing a lot of keratoconus patients. And it was really clear that there was an unmet need there, that there was nothing that we could offer these patients to stop their progression or slow their progression. And so when I received the call about the position at Avedro and the opportunity to jump on board, it was really exciting to me as an opportunity, again, to impact patients on a global scale. Once I started at the company, I don't think I ever really look back to clinical practice. I still have the opportunity to impact patients' lives, but I just do it in a different way now.
Spoken as a true superhero, I would say. So now I know that we don't have you for long. So obviously you're here today so you can illuminate on, you know, what's fact and what's fiction for us. Despite the fact that clinical acceptance for cross-linking has really gained a lot of traction within the last, you know, 2 years or so, ever since FDA approval, although the clinical momentum is palpable within the United States, of course, we know we're lagging behind slightly from our European and our abroad counterparts from abroad. But, you know, despite the fact that we've come so far, with the United States, it still feels like sometimes there are some clinical misunderstandings that can prevail. So if you don't mind, I'm going to dig into the question list. I actually was able to pull a lot of my respected colleagues who gave me a lot of questions to entertain and hopefully to maybe to see if one of them will even stump you. My guess it's not going to.
Give it your best shot, Clark.
And I've broken down the questions that I think are very interesting into three sections. And this is for my viewers, just so they could follow along. Patient selection, first section. I'm gonna ask you questions also about treatment technique and intraoperative expectations, as well as co-management, and the third section, co-management, perioperative management. So are you ready?
I'm ready, Clark.
Ah, good. Okay. So just again, so that we are all on the same page, because there may still be a little bit of, you know, hesitation on exactly what cross-linking is and how far it has come. Could you remind our listeners what corneal cross-linking is and what the clinical significance is?
Sure. So corneal cross-linking is a minimally invasive medical procedure. So simply put, a mechanism of action relies on activation of a riboflavin photosensitizer with a metered dose of 365 nanometer UV light. So really, it's a photochemical process. It creates additional covalent bonds within the extracellular matrix of the collagen fibers that make up the corneal stroma. So these new bonds that form within the stroma have a stiffening effect, and the procedure is indicated to slow the progression of keratoconus and corneal ectasia. A few other things that are clinically significant about corneal cross-linking. So keratoconus and ectasia are progressive diseases. The onset of these diseases is in the teenage years. So really any procedure aimed at stopping that progression is going to have a significant clinical interest and significant impact. If we don't check these diseases, they result in progressive steepening of the cornea, increasing irregular astigmatism, loss of best corrected visual acuity, aberrations, difficulty driving at night, and 10 to 20% of keratoconus patients eventually progress to require corneal transplant. So cross-linking is the first and only procedure indicated to slow the progression of keratoconus.
That's such a great point, because we still have to remember that ultimately it's about improving the quality of life, not just the visual function itself, but also the quality of life for our patients. I can hear the passion in your voice, and I'm sure my listeners will too. And so thank you for giving us the explanation on the background of cross-linking. A lot of people, you know, may still be in the mindset where they feel like, well, but it's such a new procedure. And because it's new, potentially it's also not covered by insurance. What do you say to that?
I guess there's two questions there. One about whether cross-linking is truly a new procedure or whether it's an investigational procedure. And then I think a second question about the insurance. So let me take the first one first. So I would say that's a myth. Cross-linking is, or the FDA-approved version of cross-linking is no longer considered an investigational procedure. So a few different reasons. One, the cross-linking that was studied in the US is based on a treatment protocol that was originally introduced in Europe around 2004 by a group in Dresden, Germany. That led to the development of a series of clinical trials. And the application that led to FDA approval of corneal cross-linking in the US was supported by three prospective, pivotal, randomized, sham-controlled US phase 3 clinical trials that demonstrated the safety and efficacy of the protocol for epi-off cross-linking. So the procedure is FDA approved. It's been vetted by the FDA through a rigorous process and through rigorous clinical trials. Now, I would say that a growing number of carriers are issuing positive coverage policies for FDA approved cross-linking. When we began this process, there were probably three carriers covering cross-linking, and now we're up to about 40. Even just recently, Humana, which is one of the largest insurance carriers in the US, has announced a decision to cover FDA approved cross-linking. So it used to be our response to this question was that cross-linking is a new procedure, not yet covered by insurance, but now more and more patients are finding that coverage is available. So it's still an evolving process. There are still some carriers that aren't yet covering cross-linking or that have a silent policy on corneal cross-linking. So we would recommend that patients reach out to their insurance coverage, their insurance provider. But certainly we're moving in a positive direction with more and more carriers covering cross-linking.
That's great. And that certainly would be good news to open up access to cross-linking for a lot more patients within the United States. So we're hoping to see that list grow in terms of medical insurance coverage, for sure. And so while we're on the topic then, you've alluded to the fact that yes, although it may not be investigational no more because of FDA approval and the rigorous clinical studies that cross-linking had to go through and demonstrate in order to obtain FDA approval, a lot of doctors may still perceive it as inevitably as a new procedure. And a lot of times that also means to a lot of clinicians that if it's new, it's going to be a last resort treatment option that you offer to patients and maybe even potentially only to those who have severe disease stage. What would you say in terms of line of logic?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Clark. I think as optometrists, we're used to thinking of procedures or surgeries as a last resort after other interventions have already failed. Maybe a patient can no longer function with their treatment modalities. I think we need to think about cross-linking a little bit differently. So cross-linking really is an early intervention, and it's intended to slow progression. As keratoconus progresses, it becomes more challenging to manage. And so we shouldn't put off treatment for patients who are showing signs of progression. It's not in our patient's best interest to let progression continue, especially when we have an opportunity to intervene and slow that progression.
That sounds great. So since we're on the topic of progression then, and again, this is keratoconus, and it is a disease where we often associate with age. Right. So we think that the earlier the patients with earlier onsets who are at a younger age when the disease manifests, they have greater likelihood to progress versus somebody who's in their fourth decade of life. Clinicians may kind of debate about with whether or not these patients even progress at all. Is there any need to discuss cross-linking for those who are Let's start with the older group of patients, the adult patients. Is there still a need to discuss cross-linking as a treatment option if you are in your fourth decade of life?
We know that keratoconus progression generally slows with age, but I think we have to be careful to think not in averages, but to evaluate each individual case. So the clinical literature is pretty clear that while on average, keratoconus progression slows over time, in some patients it can occur well into the 30s. Actually, there was a recent paper out of New Zealand that was published in the British Journal of Ophthalmology. They looked at patients over the age of 30. I think the average age enrolled in the study was 38. They saw that while most of the eyes showed little progression, up to about 37% of those patients showed at least one diopter progression in topographic parameters in at least one eye over the study period. So the keratoconus typically slows as patients age. It's more rapid progression in younger ages on average, but it's not impossible and maybe not even that uncommon for keratoconus to continue to progress into the 30s.
That's great. Thank you for giving us also evidence-driven data so that we could look it up. I know I'm certainly going to look up that study right after you and I talk tonight.
I think it's in the October 2017 issue.
That's perfect. In that case, I think I just also want to remind viewers, and I hope you agree with me, yes, cross-linking is approved for as a keratoconus management as well as an ectasia following refractive surgery currently in the United States. So it's also important to remember that it certainly is possible for ectasia to occur at a much later stage as well, and not to lump the life cycle of those two conditions, even though they're intimately related, but not to kind of lump in that general life cycle of keratoconus with ectasia, because it's possible that those patients can certainly progress at a later age.
That's a great point. And in the U.S. clinical trials that led to approval of cross-linking, we actually enrolled patients age 14 up through age 65. And so that's what the FDA-approved indication is for. So we need to document progression, but if there is a patient that's in that older category that is still showing progression, certainly cross-linking may be an option.
I see. And so does that mean that if patient for whatever, through whatever clinical testing, if no progression is detected, does that mean there's no need to discuss cross-linking then?
It's always important to discuss cross-linking. So cross-linking isn't indicated in every patient, but anytime you have a patient with keratoconus in your chair, I think it's important to lay out for them the whole roadmap of care with patients with keratoconus or corneal ectasia. You don't want to wait till they've lost vision to let them know what to expect. And you don't want a patient ever to be able to, or ever to come to you and say that you never warned them or that you never told them about this. There's a lot of information on the internet about cross-linking. They'll hear about cross-linking from other sources. You want to make sure that they're getting accurate information from you. And if it's not indicated in their case, you need to be able to explain to your patient why that is the case. Another thing to think about is if a patient doesn't know that there's a treatment option out there for them, then they may be less likely to come in to be monitored for progression. And that's not in the best interest of the patient to have them feel like there's no opportunity to stop it if it does begin to progress.
And that's a great point. And leading to the fact that since we're talking about patient self-monitoring, and we know that a lot of patients they monitor themselves, or they, you know, they try to determine how well they're doing by the way they see. And then we can't blame them, because that we emphasize on their visual function, and specifically visual, high contrast visual acuity whenever they come in for their exam. So does that mean that if they're seeing well with contact lenses, maybe then there's really not a, again, not a clinical need to discuss cross-linking them because they're functioning really well?
I wouldn't say that's the case. You know, when we're talking about progressive disease, we can't assume that patients who are functioning well today will continue to do so, especially if we're continuing to change their contact lenses. At some point, we're going to hit a wall where we can no longer correct that. Right. And a contact lens may be masking progression that's truly there. So we want to make sure that we're looking at other indicators of keratoconus progression besides just visual function. Things like corneal thickness, contact lens tolerance, maybe back surface curvature.
And those are a lot of the criteria that were utilized in the multi-center study as well, correct?
That's correct.
In terms of determining progression. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, I want the sort of listeners to make sure they heard us discussing this next point. And that is, should all keratoconus patients then be cross-linked or be offered to offer cross-linking service? Is that what you're telling us?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I think that we should talk about cross-linking with any patient that has keratoconus so that they understand the landscape and the options for care that are out there. But I think as with any procedure, there are factors to consider. I think most importantly, cross-linking is indicated during progressive stages of the disease. And so if a patient is truly not progressive, then cross-linking isn't right for them.
Okay, good to know. And since we're talking about, so I'm going to enter the second section where we are, I want to ask you a few questions that I've received regarding treatment protocols and intraoperative setting. So could you describe to us, we've sort of alluded to the fact that it was, you know, the approval came in early 2017. Just because an approval is given, some people tend to think, well, any type of cross-linking is approved because there's the FDA approval. And I think that there's that misconception out there. So could you describe to us what is currently approved under FDA guideline?
Sure. So the procedure that was approved in 2016 is an epi-off technique. So after epithelial debridement, we apply a riboflavin formulation called Photrexa viscus. It's applied at 2-minute intervals for 30 minutes. After that, the patient's examined in a slit lamp and assess for the presence of a flare in the anterior chamber. That's an indication that there's adequate riboflavin in the corneal stroma. Once that flare is detected, the next step is to measure the corneal thickness using pachymetry. If the thickness is less than 400 microns, then we actually switch over to a second riboflavin formulation called Photrexa to swell the cornea. Once that cornea reaches a 400 micron thickness, then the treating physician can move forward with applying the UV. So UV is applied for a 30-minute period. It's a 3 milliwatt continuous irradiation. And during the irradiation, additional Photrexa drops are applied at 2-minute intervals.
And since you talked about the fact that prior to UV irradiation, mm-hmm. pachymetry is usually checked just as a clinical mm-hmm. measure. So what kind of significance, number one, does that test indicate? And does that mean that if somebody may be too thin to ever be cross-linked?
So great question. So the corneal thickness is measured at the start of irradiation. So the thickness that we're talking about in the FDA protocol, that 400 microns, isn't at the time that the procedure starts, but it's at the time that the UV irradiation starts. So the cornea needs to be able to be swollen to 400 microns before that UV can be turned on. So in some cases, patients with thinner corneas can be thickened up with the Photrexa drop to meet that minimum. Not every patient can reach that thickness. So it's better if patients can be sent in for an evaluation for cross-linking earlier in the course of the disease before the cornea gets that thin. But if you have a thin patient in your chair, it's worth evaluating whether they would be a good candidate for cross-linking.
And there, that highlights obviously the importance of early detection prior to patient losing their visual quality, because presumably if we detect patients early, then they don't get so thin to the point where we may have to discuss the possible clinical conundrum of we will do the epi-off debridement under FDA approval, and then if we swell or not swell, and then may have to either will take a long time or may have to even abort the procedure that day and reevaluate on another day. So that certainly I would think is a take-home message for our primary practice colleagues out there to not wait until, as you said, patients who are too thin to then be put into that clinical situation.
Very nicely put. That's exactly the message I was trying to convey.
Well, it only took me 24 minutes to read your mind, so I would say that's a record. for me. So let me give you some of our questions that I receive with regard to co-management section perioperative. So since we discussed the epithelium of cross-linking and all the benefit of cross-linking that you had just mentioned, I would also like to touch up on some of the perceived and potential complication that people you often cite with regard to epithelium off type of treatment protocol. And number one, because, you know, obviously that reflects in the reservation of wanting to refer your patients and then potentially only waiting until they're very thin because you don't want to subject patients to undue risk. So what about the risk of infection after epithelium off cross-linking? Is that highly increased compared to other protocol? Is that something to be concerned about?
So, you know, I think anytime we remove the epithelium or place a bandaged contact lens, there's always risk of infection. But patients are managed just like you would with a PRK patient. We use topical antibiotics and we follow the patients daily until the epithelium is closed. So again, it's not without risk of infection, but I think that we should think of it in the context that we think of for PRK. Anytime we do a surgical intervention, we do introduce some risk of infection, but it can be managed.
You bring up a great point. Great point, because after all, we do very well in managing, you know, how a patient healing after PRK in the immediate post-op period, and the rate of infection also is quite low given the efficacy of our topical treatment. But what about other potential complications such as haze or corneal steepening and thinning after cross-linking?
Sure. So the most common adverse event we see after cross-linking is haze. We see this in most patients that undergo cross-linking. And it's an expected finding. It's part of the healing response that occurs as the keratocytes repopulate into the corneal stroma. This haze is typically transient, and it's most prevalent or most pronounced in the first few weeks after cross-linking. And then it sort of coalesces to form what we often refer to as a demarcation line, which some look at as a potential indicator of the depth of the cross-linking reaction. So haze isn't necessarily visually significant. It's typically transient and healing and part of the healing response.
Perfect. And what about steepening and thinning?
So on average, the cornea is going to look worse before it looks better. So it's very common to see an initial steepening of the cornea at 1 month and then gradual changes as the epithelium remodels. It's also pretty typical to see an early postoperative thinning, which returns towards baseline over 12 months. So I think it's important to recognize that these types of findings aren't unexpected and aren't necessarily a negative thing. So we should remember that the epithelium in patients with keratoconus is conventionally thinner over the area of the cone and tends to be a little thicker surrounding the cone. And so that sometimes masks the full extent of the keratoconus. When we've debrided the epithelium to do the epi-off cross-linking procedure, we've essentially unmasked the keratoconus, right? So as that epithelium grows back in, it grows in evenly, and the cornea may look steeper than it did prior to the procedure. Over time, over that first few months after the procedure, the epithelium is going to remodel, rethicken in the area around the cone, and we'll see a gradual flattening that typically continues up, potentially up through that 12-month follow-up visit.
Great. And as you're explaining the recovery period and what I call hand-holding period, because if you didn't tell the patient ahead of time, sometimes both the, you know, patient and the clinicians are slightly concerned about this, you know, secret getting worse before it gets better. So you can understand some of the hesitation of people thinking, I'm a little concerned about having to do all that for my patient and not only put them through that, let's call it robust recovery process, but also they're worried about their chair time. So that sort of leads to this next very controversial point, and something I've heard from a lot of speakers, and that is maybe then any type of cross-linking is better than no cross-linking. So why strictly perform the FDA-approved protocol?
Yeah, so I think that this is a common misconception. You know, I think one thing we should always keep in mind is that keratoconus is a serious, progressive, vision-threatening disease. We have a procedure that's been shown to be safe and efficacious, and it's been shown to be safe and efficacious in serious, well-controlled clinical trials, and has passed a very rigorous evaluation by the FDA. So it's really in our patients' best interest to put our best foot forward, offer them a procedure that we know has been fully vetted. And we shouldn't really delay offering them that procedure while we tinker with alternative approaches. So any alternative technique needs to undergo the same rigorous evaluation before we can offer in clinical practice. And we have to hold it to the same bar of safety and efficacy that we required to get off FDA approval.
Spoken like a true researcher, I would say.
Something I care about a lot, Clark.
And I know that. So I'm getting greedy here. I know we're at the time point where you probably have to run, but would you stay with me for just a couple more questions?
Sure.
Okay. So I want to bring it. So at the end of this perioperative co-management section, what I want to ask you this question. Because a lot of patients after a medical procedure or surgical procedure, a keratoconus patient that is, they often feel like, I'm cured, right? I don't need to see my eye doctor anymore because now I don't have keratoconus. And you and I have heard that a lot from patients. So do you think what do you say to the patients or to even to the doctors who are worried for their patients that their patients get into this mindset that they don't need any more medical care after cross-linking?
Yeah, so I think it's important that patients with keratoconus understand that they still have keratoconus. We may have stopped the progression, but the underlying disease state is there. They need ongoing care. We need to continue to manage their visual needs. We need to assess their overall ocular health. We need to keep on them about not rubbing their eyes and further weakening the cornea that's been strengthened by cross-linking. And we need to watch them for any signs that progression has restarted or resumed. So I think that patients with keratoconus need to understand that lifetime care is still needed. Cross-linking is intended to slow their progression and improve the course of their disease, but it doesn't mean that they shouldn't still be watched and followed for their keratoconus.
That's very informative. Thank you. So any patients who are part of my Chain Reaction Nation, take note. You still need to see your primary care doctors regardless of how successful your cross-linking treatment has been.
And don't rub your eyes.
Exactly. And I have a surprise section that I didn't announce earlier, so I'm going to surprise you with it. Now that I have you, a true researcher, in my chair, I want to throw in a question about future innovations that is upcoming. And so I just a small disclaimer to my listeners, and that is that I'm obviously a part of Cornea Service at Wales Eye, and we are looking into very enthusiastically in being able to potentially in the near future participate in the Avedro Phase 3 clinical trials. However, I don't yet have all the information. Now that I have you here, I was wondering if you could introduce us to a brief description of what is this upcoming Phase 3 study all about?
Sure. So we are really excited about this trial. So this is the first pivotal U.S. Phase 3 clinical trial to investigate an epi-on approach for corneal cross-linking intended to support an FDA approval filing. So we're actively enrolling now in multiple centers. We have a target enrollment of 275 patients. It's a multi-center randomized sham-controlled trial. And the bar for this trial is really high. We're testing the same efficacy endpoints that were used in our epi-off trials. So the treatment approach we're investigating is novel. We're aimed at addressing the three key components of corneal cross-linking photochemistry. So that's photosensitizer, UV, and oxygen. So our study is evaluating a procedure that incorporates a new riboflavin drug specifically designed for epithelium on application, a new irradiation protocol that incorporates a pulsed UV delivery protocol, and the addition of supplemental oxygen, which we supply through specially designed goggles that the patient wears during the procedure. So we think the approach is really innovative, and we're really eager to see the outcome.
And I'm sure my listeners will be very eager to hear you share the interim data with us potentially sometime in the future. So I hope I can get you back to come back once that we have more data that can be shared.
We'd love to share the data as soon as I'm allowed to.
Now, so at our last few moments, would you mind telling the listeners from Chain Reaction Nation in terms of where they would be able to find you next? And if you would be also open to answering questions, should they have any? And if they do, I assume that we'll be able to share your email information on our website.
Absolutely. So you can find me in the Avedro booth at the Academy of Optometry meeting coming up this fall. I'll also be at the Academy of Ophthalmology for any ophthalmologists that are listening. Or you can contact me by email, like Clark said. I'm sure we can post the email address on the Chain Reaction page.
Well, and thank you for giving us that permission, because we were going to do it even if you say no. I'm just joking.
I know.
So I want to conclude and thank you for freeing your time to be with me and our listener tonight, Dr. Lido. And want to also take a moment to thank our listeners for checking out this new episode of my podcast. I hope this discussion has been as clinically enlightening to you as it has been certainly for me. And now, of course, you see why it takes months to set up each special episode because of the quality of the speakers, of the colleagues that I invite. And here in Chain Reaction, I won't settle until we get the best clinical expert in the field on this show. So please check back often for the our new episode releases. And I will see you inside of the Chain Reaction next time. Thank you, Dr. Lido.
Thank you, Clark.
Chain Reaction Nation can follow me on social media and also find me at eye care conferences throughout the year. So mark your calendars and journey on all the latest adventures with me. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, comment on every episode. Let's stay connected until we meet next time here at the Chain Reaction.